Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. ESG, or Environmental, Social, Governance, promises to help the bottom line and the planet at the same time. Is it too good to be true? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of an episode digging into that very question.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. So wait, what just happened? A few short weeks ago, it looked like the United States and Iran were about to go to war. A few days later, Iranians took to the streets to protest their government's cover-up of the shooting down of a Ukrainian passenger jet. A couple of months ago, there were mass protests across Iran because of economic hardships brought on by U.S. sanctions. Now, things seem to have gone pretty quiet. But, of course, headlines aren't a great barometer to understand the real complexity of a story. So we're wondering, is this a lull before a storm? And if so, what kind of storm? Between the United States and Iran, or perhaps inside Iran? This hour on Point, Iran, the Iranian people, and the United States. And you can join us after the U.S.'s assassination of a top Iranian general and Iran's retaliatory missile strike on a U.S. base in Iraq. Do you think both countries have blinked, or do you think there's another chapter coming soon? Iranian and Iranian Americans, what do you see here, and what are your family telling you back home? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Well, we're going to start today with Farnaz Fasihi. She writes about Iran for the New York Times. On Monday, she published a fascinating, detailed account of how that Ukrainian passenger jet was shot down and then the ensuing cover-up by the Iranian government. There's a link to our website to Farnaz's story at onpointradio.org. Farnaz, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
So first of all, I mean, let's start with some of the fascinating details in your story. What were the decisions that led to Iran keeping the airspace over Tehran open during the time that Ukrainian airliner first took off?
Well, Iran had alerted all its forces and placed them on high alert, expecting that the United States might strike back. And as you pointed out in your introduction, that evening it looked like Iran and the U.S. might go to war with one another. So Iran is on maximum high alert, but they failed to close down civilian airspace or ground flights, which was a tragic miscalculation. There were two reasons behind this, two deliberations. One was that they thought that closing down the airport might create a public panic. People might think that war is imminent with the United States. The other reason that some people I spoke to in Iran told me was that the revolutionary commanders thought that if the airport was open, it would protect them against U.S. military strikes on the airport or on some of the military bases around the airport, effectively taking passengers on airplanes as human shields.
I see. Well, so is it in the hours before the Ukrainian passenger jet was shot down that there was some kind of miscommunication from the Central Air Defense Command in Iran that had said that American warplanes were headed into Iranian airspace?
The head of Revolutionary Guards Aerospace Force, which was in charge of the air defense around the airport, said that the few hours before the missiles were shot at the civilian plane, Ukrainian Airlines, there were reports that U.S. Cruise missiles were on the way to Iran.
Oh, I see.
And that American fighter jets had taken off from United Arab Emirates. Subsequently, apparently, he said that false alarm had been rectified, but the operator of that surface-to-air defense unit that shot down the plane had not heard it. The commander of the Revolutionary Guard also said that this operator of the defense unit had tried to contact Central Command to ask to seek permission or authorization and was not able to connect because of jamming or some problem. And he had 10 seconds to decide, and he shot down the plane with two missiles.
Okay. Now, the reason why we appreciate that you going through the detail about this with us. It's because it helps us to understand what was happening on the ground in Iran earlier this month. So first of all, just remind us, the Revolutionary Guard is separate from Iran's regular army, right?
Correct. Iran has two military forces. One is the regular army, with an army head and sort of the ranks of the general. The Revolutionary Guards was created after the revolution as a buffer against military coups to protect the Islamic Republic against a potential coup by the army or the army turning against it as it had done by the Shah. They were tasked at the beginning of the revolution to protect Iran borders and threats outside and inside of the country against the regime. Over the past 40 years, the role and the influence of the guards has expanded, and they now control a vast sector of the economy. They are extremely influential in politics. They are in charge of Iran's regional policies through their Quds forces and created proxy militia from Iraq to Lebanon to Syria to sort of expand Iran's regional influence and its interests. So they are a formidable force. They're really an anchor of power in Iran. They're not just a military force, but they're very much an economic and a political powerhouse as well. And they have an outside power over the government. As we pointed out in the story, the Revolutionary Guard commanders knew immediately that their missiles had brought down a plane. They knew it within moments after this had happened. They were notified, and they covered it up for 3 days. They deliberately decided to cover it up, not just from the public, not just from the outside world, but from the government of Iran,
right,
from the president of Iran, from the parliament. And that's truly stunning that they would feel that they could get away with this, or that, you know, President Rouhani could be kept in the dark for 3 days.
Right. So that's the fascinating part of your reporting here, right? Because as you note, Ayatollah Khamenei had been notified that this had happened.
Right.
Apparently, there was a secret investigative committee that was drawn to really determine specifically what had happened. But while all this was going on, President Rouhani did not know. I mean, how did that?
Well, I mean, it just tells you about who's really in charge in Iran, right?
Right.
I mean, this goes to speak about how the power really does not lie within elected officials in Iran. That the guards have significant power over elected officials, and the system or the regime is really the one in charge. Ayatollah Khamenei knew Wednesday night what had happened. The investigative committee had concluded by Wednesday sunset that the missiles had brought down the plane. But they didn't. The key thing is that not only did the Revolutionary Guards cover it up, not only did they not inform, but they went the other way. They aggressively put out a false narrative. They said absolutely, there's absolutely no missiles fired. This is the psychological warfare from the West. They are trying to take the momentum away from us because we attacked the U.S., and so for the 3 days, government officials and military commanders were going on television and giving interviews and speaking to world leaders, saying that, no, this has not happened. And actually it had.
Right. And I can imagine President Rouhani is taking calls from all over the world, Canada in particular, thinking, what's going on? What has happened?
Right.
So what changed? Right. But then, as you said, over the course of those 72 hours, something turned. How did that change? What changed?
What turned was really international and internal pressure. You know, Iranians are collectively traumatized by this event, both Iranians who are in Iran and who are outside of Iran. I don't remember any other single incident traumatizing Iranians, and I'm Iranian-American myself, the way that the tragedy of this airplane did, because they were really innocent people. They were not political. They were not activists. They had nothing to do with anything. They went home to visit their family members, and it could be any one of us. It could be any one of our family members. And they were shot down by military forces of their own country. And also there was this cover-up. So there was a lot of public pressure building. There were a lot of demands for answers inside Iran and also outside. I mean, Prime Minister of Canada, Justin Trudeau, took a very firm stand saying that we absolutely will get to the bottom of it. And I think when he gave the press conference saying we have evidence that Iran mistakenly may have shot down this plane, I think in Iran, the calculation was, okay, now we have to tell Rouhani, and once they informed him, he threatened to resign. He was angry, and he thought, you know, Iran cannot handle another crisis with the world. We're already under sanctions. We already had this massive uprising in November that we crushed and killed hundreds of people. And the truth will eventually, be revealed, and U.S. or Canada and others might actually make their evidence public, and it would be very embarrassing for Iran. The guards were pushing to cover this up for a couple of weeks, for a couple of months, as long as the black box needed to be read and as long as the investigations took, to sort of buy themselves time to manage this crisis. Mm. Rouhani pushed back, and then we had, right. Apparently Ayatollah Khamenei intervened, and then we had the extraordinary statement saying that that this had actually happened. And in his statement, President Rouhani said that he just found out a few hours before. Mm. And to me, that was a stunning admission of the limits of his power.
Yeah.
Over a country that he's supposed to be the president.
Farnaz, if I just jump in here for a second, because this part of your story is so critically important, because when Rouhani said, we have to tell the world, according to your reporting, the military officials have pushed back, not because they wanted to reveal the truth, but because they were concerned about the fallout it might have within Iran. Is that right?
Exactly. Exactly. They knew. I mean, even when the truth, as we saw what happened when the statement was, when they owned their mistake and admitted their mistake, there were immediately protests all around Iran. People were coming out to grieve, and the anti-government chants targeted Ayatollah Khamenei. They called him a murderer. They said that his regime was obsolete, and there was a lot of public anger manifesting in forms of protests and crackdowns. And so they wanted to try to control it. They knew that if they admitted, people would come out, and that's exactly what happened.
Well, we are talking about what's happened inside Iran over the past 4 weeks since that flashpoint between the United States and Iran. Farnaz Fasihi joins us today. She writes about the country for the New York Times. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. A recent episode featured a debate about ESG, or environmental social governance.
This sounds like more work than just putting your money into a social impact fund.
It's a lot more work.
Yeah.
Anybody who thinks there's an easy solution here is either engaged in puffery, greenwash, or deceiving themselves.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about what's been going on inside Iran over the past 4 weeks after that flashpoint between the United States and Iran at the start of 2020. I'm joined today by Farnaz Fasihi. She writes about Iran for the New York Times. She's with us from New York. And joining us now from Washington is Suzanne Maloney. Suzanne's deputy director of the Foreign Policy Program at the Brookings Institution, and her previous work includes being an external advisor to senior State Department officials on Iran. So Suzanne Maloney, welcome to On Point.
Thanks so much for having me.
First of all, I was wondering if you might reflect with us on Farnaz's reporting and the story she was telling us about the lengths to which the Revolutionary Guard went to cover up the downing of the Ukrainian airliner, and Iranians who were on, and the deaths of the Iranians who were on board. What does that tell you about what's happening inside Iran right now?
Yeah, I think it's a fascinating and really important development that to some extent has been overlooked in the frenzy of attention to the strike that killed Revolutionary Guards Quds Force Commander Qasem Soleimani earlier in the month. But this downing of the airliner has significant implications, I think, for the internal politics of the Islamic Republic and for the legitimacy of the country with it, or the government with its own people. What's interesting about Farnaz's piece, I think, is the dimensions of the dynamics within the regime itself. There's always been a sort of competitiveness within the Iranian government. There are different factions from the outset. There are different power centers. And there are also, I think, quite clear attempts to try to control the narrative, particularly as it became clear that the Iranian government as a whole was being very directly and publicly blamed for this. I would actually emphasize the role of the international community in ensuring that the truth came out, because it was Prime Minister Justin Trudeau of Canada who came out on the really 24 hours after the downing of the plane and went public with the very firm assertion that it was Iran that had, in fact, struck the plane accidentally. And I think it was that public admission by the international community that really forced the hand of the Iranian government as a whole to take responsibility for the strike.
Mm. Well, you heard Farnaz say, though, and also her reporting, which, by the way, we have a link to Farnaz's story at onpointradio.org. If you haven't already read it, listeners, I highly suggest that you do, because it's quite incredible. But that, you know, a major aspect of this is, you know, for quite some time, 70 hours or so, President Rouhani was kept in the dark. And what, I mean, so, yeah, that tells us about where the real heart of power is in Iran. But does it also tell us something about the overall, I don't know, fragility or stability of the regime as it is right now?
Well, I think it's hard to know for certain exactly what Rouhani knew and when he knew it. It's convenient for him, of course, to come out and those around him to come out now and say, I really had no information. It's the guards that were keeping this information secret. It's a little bit difficult to imagine that, given the extent of the discussion on social media, the fact that the international media had already very clearly pointed the finger at Iran's own armed forces, that Rouhani was completely oblivious to that possibility, even as he and those around him were pushing back very forcefully on that narrative in the public domain. Rouhani is under fire. He's, responsible and considered to be the most public advocate for the nuclear deal, which, of course, the Trump administration walked away from. Even before that decision in May of 2018, Rouhani's promise to bring about a better economy for the Iranian people was under, I think, real strain. He simply wasn't able to undertake the significant structural economic reforms that the country really needs to be competitive, to attract foreign and domestic investment, even before the reimposition of sanctions. And that's why we saw 2 years ago really significant protests rock the country over the course of late 2017, early 2018. Those were mostly undertaken by Iranians who were frustrated about economic conditions. We saw that again this past November when the government was forced to raise gasoline prices. They did it in a very heavy-handed way, announcing a 50% price increase overnight. And that brought people once again to the streets in a very furious and violent way, burning down gas stations, banks, striking out at symbols of the regime. And so I think Rouhani at this point, to some extent, is trying to salvage his own credibility within a competitive system to try to ensure that he doesn't go down as the scapegoat for all of this regime's blunders and missteps. Mm.
Farnaz Fasihi, what do you think about that?
I think Susan's right. Rouhani is under his legitimacy is at question. I think that for many Iranians, they see him, they blame him just as much as they blame the Revolutionary Guards and participating in the cover-up. We're not really having enough power. And as we see, there are parliamentary elections coming up in February in Iran, and it's the turnout is going to probably be very low because people, over the years keep putting their stocks and believing these presidential candidates who come and promise reform and change, and nothing really is delivered. And there's a real sense of, from inside Iran, as Susan mentioned, of being just fed up with the establishment, fed up with the promise of reform not being delivered, promise of economic prosperity and engaging with the world just falling short. And, you know, in the protests that have erupted over the past year, we see that the demands of the people are going further than we want reformists, we want this candidate, and targeting the entire establishment of the Islamic Republic. So people within Iran who are angry, who are critical of this of the Islamic Republic regime, are not really differentiating anymore between the different factions. Yes, there are nuances, there are different political factions, they're not all the same, but for the intents and purposes of what the public wants and the kind of change they want, all sides have failed.
Right. So Farnaz, I mean, and Suzanne, let's just acknowledge for a moment that different groups of people can be both critical of their government and supportive of the government at the same time. It's never just one or the other, right? In any nation. And
correct.
And that's what I was thinking when, you know, we went from seeing those that spasm of grief over the death of Soleimani to a couple of days later, a spasm of grief over the cover up of the downing of that jetliner. I mean, it wasn't as sort of whiplashy as one might think. But what I'm curious about is are there different groups of people in Iran right now, and Suzanne, I'll turn this to you, who have different concerns about or grievances with the regime? And do we see a coming together of these groups that could destabilize the regime?
Well, that's a really interesting point. What was notable to me about the protests that emerged from the vigils that were organized to honor those who were lost in the downing of the Ukrainian jetliner was how many of them were university students. Many of them began on university campuses, these protests. And that was a constituency we hadn't seen come out to the streets in a significant fashion almost since the 2009 protests over the rigged re-election of Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, which produced the Green Movement and some of the most significant post-revolutionary opposition developments in the past 40 years within Iran. The other types of, demonstrations, rallies, and even riots that we've seen over recent years have tended to come from lower class segments of the population. They've often happened outside the center of major cities, in the kind of exurbs, as Iran has grown rapidly over the past few decades. These are the segments, the areas that are most, I think, economically deprived and frustrated. But what we're seeing now is that the kind of traditional constituency of students, upper middle class, they saw themselves on that plane. They saw their own hopes and dreams of studying abroad, of achieving a life where they could fly in and out of Iran, have opportunities to engage internationally. And they saw the government trying to cover it up, as it has covered up violence against dissidents and other scandals in the Islamic Republic repeatedly over the past 40 years. So I think we do have different groups around the country upset and dissatisfied and alienated from the government on a variety of different issues. I don't yet see that kind of convergence between them. I don't see the framework of an opposition, and I don't see a kind of leadership that might be able to galvanize and bring them together. But I'd also note that, you know, when you think back 40, 41 years ago, most people sitting outside the country didn't really appreciate that Iran was in a pre-revolutionary state or in the midst of a revolution until well after it was over. So it's not entirely apparent that we would know, even if there were, sort of the embryonic structure of an opposition movement beginning to converge.
Interesting. Okay, so Farnaz, let me just, it makes me wonder how the internal dynamic inside Iran right now, how that might inform what we need to be thinking about in terms of, you know, the possibility of an ongoing Iranian response to the United States. Like, how much is what's happening inside Iran with the Iranian people on the minds of Ayatollah Khamenei and President Rouhani as they think about how to deal with the U.S.?
I think that they make these. I don't think it weighs much on their on their decision making because we've seen them violently crack down any time that the public comes out and demands something. I think that the grand policies of the Islamic Republic that have to do with their nuclear program or relationship with the United States or their regional influence and meddlings and whatnot are really taken in as what will make the Islamic Republic survive. Survival has always been at the core goal of the Islamic Republic, and when needed, they have conceded. When their survival was at stake, they have shown that they will concede, as they did with the nuclear energy. And now we have to see whether they're going to concede, because sanctions are really hurting the regime. That they're really facing a serious budget deficit. They don't have money to pay their government workers. They pay back. They owe back pay of salaries to government workers, and if they don't pay them, that could cause another round of protests. They're having real issues. Selling oil exporting oil has gone from over 1 million barrels a day to now 200,000, 300,000. And even when they sell it, they don't have access to the cash. They can't easily bring it back. So they have to really recalculate in terms of will we see retaliation for General Soleimani. I think that the theater to watch that is the proxy groups in the region.
Right.
What happens in Iraq, what happens in Afghanistan and in Syria, whether Iran through these proxy groups will continue to retaliate. And they have said that they will. If we take their word for it, they have said that we're not going to the limit of our retaliation wasn't the ballistic missile attack on the U.S. military bases in Iraq, that we will continue to take revenge. So that's what we have to see. But I also would say that over the course of the past year, as President Trump has imposed a maximum pressure policy on Iran, Iran has responded in its own maximum pressure way. They've escalated tensions in the Persian Gulf, attacking tankers, shooting down an American drone, American bases coming under fire through their proxies. So they've had this dual parallel policy. At the same time that they were doing that, they're also in diplomatic talks with the Japanese Prime Minister and France's President Macron to try to see if they can renegotiate sanction relief with the United States.
Right. So Suzanne, then, I mean, I presume that during the first couple of days of this month, there was a flurry of not just overt, but back-channel diplomatic activity between Tehran and Washington. And to Farnaz's point, is that activity still going on if the presumption is that actual long-term retaliation from Iran might come through proxies over the course of months or even years?
Well, we know that in the wake of the strike on Soleimani, that the State Department communicated via the normal mechanism that's been in place for most of the past 40 years for getting in touch with the Iranians, and that it worked successfully. This is the Swiss embassy that serves as a protecting power for U.S. interests in Iran. And it's often just described as the Swiss channel. That channel was used to communicate from Washington that Iran should not escalate significantly, because, in fact, the United States would respond in kind. And what we saw was, of course, a very significant attack and to some extent, a real escalation in terms of the type of weaponry used and the targeting of U.S. personnel on an Iraqi base. But we also avoided any American fatalities, which appears to be the red line that most concerns the Trump administration. There's a debate now, of course, as to whether or not that was intentional, as the Iranians have said, that they avoided American fatalities, or whether it was just the product of good luck. And we now know, of course, that somewhere in the range of 50 American service personnel on that base were, in fact, injured enough to require medical treatment, in many cases traumatic brain injury, concussions, and other significant injuries as a result of the ballistic missile strike. I don't see much opportunity at the moment for the real kind of back-channel diplomacy about the scope and nature of an eventual agreement between the two sides. I think there's an expectation here in Washington that the Iranians are likely to continue to retaliate, that the ballistic missile strike was largely meant to demonstrate capability and intent, but it was not the end of their response to the Soleimani strike. And of course, we have to deal with the situation in Iraq, where there is growing pressure and uncertainty about the longevity of American presence there. That's something that the Iranians are definitely going to continue to agitate for. In the long term, there's really no alternative for Iran, as Farnaz eloquently explained, to having some kind of an agreement with Washington, because it's only the United States that can remove the economic pressure that's currently afflicting this regime.
And there's no immediate sign that that's going to happen for a long time.
I think the difficulty here is that, you know, President Trump sees what he did over the course of the past few months and really since the start of his administration toward Tehran as successful. Mm. Even the strike on Soleimani, which has had some fallout, it has provoked a lot of concerns across the partisan spectrum here, is seen as a net political gain for him. Mm-hmm. We got a bad guy. And ultimately, there hasn't been a meaningful backlash on U.S. interests, with the exception, of course, of the renewed pressure in Iraq.
Yeah.
For President Trump, I don't think there's a huge incentive to invest a lot of political capital in trying to find an agreement with Iran. He can continue to escalate pressure.
Yeah. Well, Suzanne Maloney and Farnaz Fasihi, stand by for just a moment. We're talking about what's been going on inside Iran over the past month since that flashpoint at the beginning of this year. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about what's been going on inside Iran and between the United States and Iran in the oddly quiet past 4 weeks after the very tense start of the year between the U.S. And Tehran. I'm joined today by Farnaz Fasihi. She writes about Iran for The New York Times. She's with us from New York. Suzanne Maloney also joins us as well. She's deputy director of the foreign policy program at the Brookings Institution. She's in Washington. Farnaz and Suzanne, if you can just hang on here for a couple of minutes, I want to turn our attention to Nicholas Pelham. He joins us from London. He's the Middle East correspondent for The Economist magazine. And in July of 2019, he traveled to Tehran for a week-long reporting trip that ended up being more than 7 weeks long, and he's here to tell us the story about why that happened. So, Nick Pelham, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna. Good to be with you.
Okay, so you were only supposed to be in Tehran for a week, but you were there for almost 2 months. So, first of all, what happened?
Journalists are they can be quite soft targets. I went in at a time of sort of more pronounced tensions between the UK and Iran. Britain had seized an oil tanker, one of Iran's largest oil tankers, and was holding it off the coast of Gibraltar. I arrived in the country, sort of spent a week as a journalist there. It had taken me some time to get a visa, was surprised it eventually came through when it did. And just as I was preparing to leave to catch my flight back home, there were seven guards who introduced themselves, and said that they had a warrant to question me for 48 hours and that if I cooperated, I might well be able to catch my flight home. I had about 3 hours left to go home. It didn't transpire. I was taken away from one round of questioning after another. At various points, I was blindfolded when I was being moved from one part of town to another. I spent some time, about a day, in solitary confinement, then a couple of days in a safe house, and then remarkably was sort of taken back to a hotel and sort of asked to remain in the city, but was left free to roam around the city while the investigation continued.
Okay, so you were detained essentially for an additional 7 weeks. I wasn't clear about whether you were told specifically why, other than that you were a journalist in Tehran.
No, I mean, initially they said that they had doubts about me as an individual. I'd spent time as a correspondent in Jerusalem, but they didn't seem particularly interested in that. They wanted to know what I'd been doing when I was in Tehran. They knew full well, because every journalist that goes in is assigned a minder, and that minder is essentially the eyes and ears of the regime while you're operating as a journalist, and sort of, to a large extent, sort of inhibits how journalists can operate. But no, it was never fully explained. And at some point, it'd be good to hear from the Iranian authorities themselves as to what their intentions were.
And as you just said, you were kept in solitary confinement for at least a day. But
it was less than a day. Actually.
Less than a day. Yeah, okay. Yeah. But over those 7 weeks, I mean, you weren't actually in a prison facility for the totality of those 7 weeks. You
were not at all. I was in a prison facility, maybe at most for. Yeah, I mean, for a few hours, certainly less than a day, and no, they were, on the whole, they were remarkably courteous and professional. There were times where it was made clear to me that if I didn't cooperate, if I didn't answer all their questions, that they could prosecute me on grounds of espionage. But that sort of threat came and went, and indeed I was on several occasions I was told that the case had been closed and I'd be on my way. It was really quite remarkable. I had, as it turned out, I had far more freedom in Tehran when I was detained than I did when I was working there as a journalist.
Right, so tell us more about that, because you were able to kind of go wherever you virtually wherever you wanted while the Iranian government was investigating you during this time. So where did you go and who did you talk with?
I mean, in some ways it was even more extraordinary than that. They gave me they kept my laptop and my phones, but they gave me another smartphone in which I could stay in touch with my family and my colleagues at work back home. And even perhaps more remarkably, I was able to record conversations and take videos and upload those. So it was kind of without a minder at my shoulder. I just thought this was the most incredible opportunity and wanted to maximize it to the full. That's a kind of very strange feeling when you're in Tehran, which is, nobody quite knows what tomorrow brings. In my case, it wasn't clear whether I might be carted off to Evin prison, which is sort of on the uptown, on the hills of Tehran, and I think that's kind of a sentiment that many Iranians live under. They never quite know whether they're going to be summoned or whether they're going to get a text message sort of hauling them in, or their family in. And so everybody lives in the moment. It's a remarkably existentialist place, and it's a kind of a place that buzzes with life and colour and culture. And, it's by far and away the most kind of cultural place, I think, capital that I've been to in the Middle East. There are almost as many plays on every night as there are in the West End of London. There are umpteen concerts, art galleries. It's a place where everybody seems to be doing something. Some incredible cafes. I mean, this little splurge of cafes that have opened across the city in the last sort of couple of years. Clearly this is, it's partially dependent on whether you have money or not. But even if you don't, I mean, there are kind of buskers in the parks who are playing music. There are people sort of dancing in the parks. There are kind of sculpture parks. It's, I think there's probably more public space in Tehran than I've encountered in any other sort of capital in the Middle East.
Well, you heard Suzanne and Farnaz
earlier in the hour talk about the amount of discontent that's with the current regime and where that discontent is coming from, the different kinds of groups in Iran. Was that reflected in the conversations you had during this extended time in Tehran, or did you encounter many supporters of the regime?
No, I find it very, very difficult to find any supporters of the regime. I mean, there's remarkable discontent. There's also kind of remarkable flexibility to express that discontent, more so than in many other countries in the Middle East. In fact, I was the one who was kind of, you know, a lot of the time I was nervous about, getting into too much hot water, and I was sure that the phone I had was a listening device, and I'd leave it at one end of the cafe in the hope that kind of nobody would overhear the conversations that I was having, and I'd ask people to sort of tamp down, and I was the one who was kind of doing the censoring and sort of monitoring and self-censoring initially, but you just couldn't avoid it. You get into a taxi, and you know, it was just really hard to find anybody who had a good word to say for the regime, and I went looking for it. I think the one thing that it's a very large city. It's the system is I think remains remarkably strong, and I think that's in some of the reporting. It's quite easy to it's undoubtedly true that sanctions are hurting people. They're biting.
If I may, just for a second, the system remains remarkably strong, do you mean as in the what do you mean by the system?
I mean the bureaucracy functions well. The kind of the despite the straitened times, you've got a functioning public transport system. You've got a better metro system than anywhere else in the Middle East. People are sweeping the streets and tending to the parks. It is a functioning society, and it doesn't appear to be a society which is functioning much less because of sanctions. And you've also got a very repressive regime, which has its cadre and has quite a loyal kind of loyal base, and is able to has all the tools of repression at its disposal. So. And I think one thing that has to be borne in mind with sanctions is that, yes, sanctions probably are hurting the regime, but they're hurting Iranians as individuals an awful lot more. And so as much as the regime is weakened, the population itself is weakened and is very used to living under conditions of Cold War and war since the history of the Islamic Republic. But, it is exhausting its coping mechanisms, and that just kind of makes the regime in many ways even stronger than before.
Right. Well, so Farnaz Fasihi, let me just turn back to you briefly here. So Nick had this unusual and extraordinary extended opportunity, even under a kind of detention. His story is fascinating about the things he got to see in Tehran. But I want to ask you, if Tehran seems as it's functioning quite well under both the regime and the sanctions, Nick also made the point that may not actually be true across the rest of Iran. The sanctions are hurting the nation, are they not?
The sanctions are definitely hurting the nation. The sanctions are hurting ordinary people because their purchasing powers have shrunk, their savings have shrunk, and also the price of everything has increased. There's a shortage of medicine. The access that they have to goods has been impacted, and the government is really short of cash. I mean, they don't make any secrets about it. President Rouhani has said, "I'm facing a massive budget deficit for next year because of sanctions and because they can't sell oil or have access to the money," as I said before. What we know is that there's a big gap of sort of economic gap between the rich and the poor in Tehran and in other places. If you talk to many ordinary lower income people in Iran, they will tell you that they haven't been able to eat meat or chicken or any kind of protein other than beans for 3 to 4 months, that they try to survive on one meal a day, that they all work two or three jobs. And for young people, coming out of college, not being able to find jobs. And even if they do, the salaries are not adequate for them to plan a life. There's a lot of discontent. The economy is really a big problem. Yes, Tehran is vibrant culturally, and so are many other Isfahan, Shiraz, and other places. But the economic pains are very real.
Mm. Well, so Nick, let me turn back to you. I'm always trying to understand or strive for getting a better sense as to what we here in the United States, when we're talking about U.S. policy vis-a-vis these other nations, what we're not understanding about the truth on the ground there. So what do you think your extended experience in Tehran, what did it open your eyes to that we don't often think about enough in the West?
I mean, there's the face that the authorities present of Iran to the outside world, and then there's Iran, and I think the two are quite different and quite distinct. If you look at sort of television at the face that the authorities aspire to, it's one where clerics are they're the communal arbiters, they're the ones who are who are the communal leaders. Women all wear chadors. You don't see a hint of hair beneath. It's a kind of conservative society, which is very much a theocracy. And when you're on the ground, you just, it's an exaggeration to say you don't see any sign of that theocracy, but you really, you know, you really don't see clerics in the street. You don't encounter clerics. You do see kind of injunctions for women to cover up, with a veil, but that's often kind of honored in the breach. This is a place which is deeply challenging, which has kind of learned over the years how to challenge. It's a sort of cat and mouse game that the population plays with the authorities. And in many ways, that kind of adds to the vibrancy, it adds to the excitement and the kind of thrill of living in Tehran. Yes, you can kind of fall foul of the authorities, but sort of everybody's living on the edge. And so, you know, that injects a sense of energy, a vibrancy. And, you know, I mean, there are pop concerts, there are cafes are sort of hosting cafes are, mm-hmm. are hosting concerts where people are singing in English. It's a kind of weddings are wild. What you don't capture in the headlines is just the color of the country.
Mm-hmm. Well, Suzanne Maloney, we've got about a minute and a half left here, and this has been a really fascinating hour in terms of talking about the political situation in Iran right now. What happened basically in those first few days of this month? Nicholas's firsthand impressions of just life, everyday life in Tehran. I'm wondering what signals you will be looking for, Suzanne, in the next couple of months or, say, half a year in terms of what might happen next in Iran, or even how the U.S. might position itself or position its policy regarding Iran.
Well, I think the key question is whether the leadership of the Islamic Republic recognizes how close they are to a real economic cliff and what they will have to do in order to back away from it. I fully agree about having spent a lot of time in Iran that this is an amazing country and amazing people, and that we have only the most limited sense of the culture and politics of Iran from the outside. But I do think it's also important to remember that it's a police state, the government at its core, and that's why it's able to detain people like Nicholas when they're coming on a reporting trip. And this is a government that's going to face, I think, a real dilemma about how to manage this economic pressure, because fundamentally the changing of the guard, if there is a change in administration here, will not lead to an immediate end to the siege or to the problems between the two countries.
Well, Suzanne Maloney, Deputy Director of the Foreign Policy Program at the Brookings Institution, thank you so very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
And Nicholas Pella, Middle East correspondent for The Economist magazine. We have a link to Nicholas's story about being detained in Tehran at onpointradio.org. Nick, thank you.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
Yeah, it's great to have you. And Farnaz Fasihi, who writes about Iran for The New York Times. We have a link to her reporting as well at our website. It's been fantastic. Farnaz, thank you so very much for being with us.
Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
Can Profit Motive Save the Planet is a company that takes the climate into account a better investment? How about one that pays workers a living wage and champions transparency and board diversity? That's the idea of ESG, or environmental social governance.
Sounds like a wonderful story. You can make more money, you can save the planet at the same time. Almost no one is going to turn that down.
It's a story that Andy King of Questrom and Veet Henish of the Wharton School challenged during a recent event at Questrom. Professor King played the critic, who says these are problems for regulation to solve, not markets.
As a famous economist said to me, you can't fix externalities with the profit motive, because the profit motive is not linked to externalities. Externalities are the byproduct of pursuing profits. So you can't fix them by getting people to even look harder at profits.
Meanwhile, Veet emphasized that ESG can be an important part of the solution.
Regulation matters, and we need better regulation. And we need to reallocate trillions of dollars of capital over time to the climate transition alone, forgetting social justice, racial justice, and other ESG issues. We're going to need the profit motive for that. No government regulation is going to reallocate tens of trillions of dollars of capital alone. It's going to be investors who are looking at current government regulation and future government regulation and trying to connect the dots.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.